Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daoust, Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our exploration of the cultures of consciousness. And one great way to explore cultures of consciousness is to explore other people's cultures of consciousness. There's nothing quite like the altered state that is even moderately extreme travel. And, you know, it's sort of it's a very funny game, because on the one hand, you go to unusual places to see and understand more about people who live very differently than you do, think differently, have a different worldview, interact religiously, philosophically, economically in ways you're not used to. And so on some level, you're exposing yourself as best you can to some real other way of being in the world. But at the same time, if you're doing that, and if you're paying attention, and if you're pulling your nose away from the guidebook and from the, you know, the established tracks of tourist reproduction, then inevitably you're going to also kind of, you know, become a bit, well, confused, opened up, facing a dream. So extreme travel is sort of like fact-finding in a dream, because it can be a very surreal experience immersing yourself in otherness, even though part of what you want to do is to connect across that otherness, and that wonderful mixture is part of what makes travel so intoxicating. And though I have not traveled as much as I would have liked to in my life, I have had quite a number of marvelous experiences. And one of my favorites was actually inspired by today's guest. We're going to be talking to Alan Bishop of Sublime Frequencies record and DVD label, and former girl of the Sun City Girls. And I was interviewing Alan about the Sun City Girls back in the day, about, I don't know, 8 years ago or so. And it was just before his label, Sublime Frequency, was going to kick into gear. And he showed me a DVD of a gathering of spirit mediums in Burma. And this was just amazing. I have never seen anything quite so marvelous and strange and intoxicating and fascinating. And so I immediately decided I had to go. And Alan spent a lot of time in Burma. And it's not the kind of place that a lot of Americans go, even though other Europeans have gone there. And, of course, things are changing very much right now. And I'd love to, we're going to talk about that a little bit. In any case, it was an intoxicating adventure and inspired one of my favorite pieces that I've written. It's in my relatively recent collection, Nomad Codes. If you want to check it out, or I think you can do a web search on the name of it, it's called Burmese Days. In any case, it was a wonderful piece, but also an experience, but also a kind of tribute to the kinds of connections that talking to people like Alan Bishop can do for you. So I'm really happy to have him on the show today. But first, we're going to bring on, of course, our co-host, Maja Daou. Maja, how's it going?
It's going good, Eric. How are you?
I always say that every week. Oh, how's it going? Really, because you never go, it's really bad this week, actually.
Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm like, eh.
But I know you're a huge Sun City Girls fan. Did you ever see them live?
I did. You know, I'm a Seattleite. I was kind of raised over in the Seattle area. So in the 90s, you know, a lot of my friends and I were really into them. And I had actually heard about them through my ex-boyfriend, who was really into the meat puppets and beat poetry. So that was kind of my avenue into Sun City Girls.
Do you remember, was there any particularly striking image or song or thing that you experienced? Because, you know, you never knew what you were going to get when you see the Sun City Girls. Sometimes they'd do a two-hour skit. Sometimes they would just play ferocious, you know, jazz, psychedelic improvisation. Sometimes they would do, you know, corny cover versions of songs you wouldn't think they would know. You know, it's like, so it was always a surprise. Do you recall
it,
anything?
It's true. I think out of all of them, my favorite thing about them was how unapologetic they were for presenting the different surprises. Like, I was at some shows where they would do, you know, like a spoken word jaunt, and then the crowd was at the club, and they weren't so into it, you know? And yet they proceeded very nonchalantly and really didn't care that the audience wasn't that thrilled.
Yeah, in a way, they were like, they took up the punk rock attitude far, far, you know, regions far beyond, you know, conventional punk rock, really a very unique American musical extravaganza. But with enough, you know, praise floating through the air, let's bring Alan on. Alan, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hey, Eric and Masha, how are you?
Good.
We're doing good, man. I'm glad to have you. Hey, every time I've talked to you, you're always, like, immersed in a gazillion projects. And I'm just kind of curious, like, what's on your plate right now? What's getting you excited?
Well, first, I wanted to ask you, is this an FCC-regulated broadcast?
What's a good question? You know,
I don't know.
I mean,
not
because
really.
You know,
no,
if I'm going to talk freely, I don't want to be thinking about, you know, dropping. I can't drop an F bomb or, you know, whatever, because that's how I talk. You know,
It's a radio thing, and I want you to be free. So I think that that's okay. I mean, you know, maybe it's.
I'm not going to go out of my way to do it, but it just helps me deal with what I'm, you know. You know, just to, I feel freer when I don't have to think about that kind of stuff. So
well,
then I won't worry about it.
I'm voting for freedom, so go
okay.
Right ahead.
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's a million things happening always, and you know, right now, as you know, Eric, we've discussed it briefly, and just recently, I've been, you know, spending time in the Middle East, and I'm out there working on Sublime projects and also working on my own solo recording and writing projects as well. And you know, I'm going to try to do an Alvarius B tour in Europe this summer, and we have, you know, of course, a million potential Sublime releases that are, you know, in various stages of production, and I don't really like to talk about them until they're really coming. But we have an exciting Malaysian comp that could be coming out very soon, and another Moroccan folk thing, and Hisham's just been to Mali, and he's working on a project there, there's a lot of things actually, and I don't know, I could go on, but then again, you know, some of these things may take, you know, months or a year or two to get out. So
sure,
you know.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things about travel in your music, you know, even, you know, going way back in the day with the origins of the Sun City Girls, there was always this sort of relationship to the outside, to the other, to the far away. And it wasn't just sort of like, you know, you guys sitting at home, like, buying weird records. It was that it came out of your own kind of travel experiences. And it seemed like you right away you figured out, but like you explored, you used the opportunity of travel to really get out of yourself, but also to tune in. And it's that mixture of getting out of yourself and tuning in to whatever's going on. I mean, literally, you used to bring, like, if I remember, you'd like bring you know, shortwave radios and record the material. You'd record stuff from the television. You were like kind of on like a, it's sort of like a collection, but at the same time, the things you were collecting were taking you even farther away from yourself. So, like, what was like the first big trip for you? That where'd you go and what
well,
happened?
First of all, you know, I would like to make clear that I have no clue what we're doing, and I don't think we ever really knew what the hell we're doing. But you know, it all started for me going to Morocco when I was in my early 20s. I think it was 1983, and the radio concept started then as well. I was recording. My brother and I and a friend were in Marbella, Spain. We were planning on going to Morocco, but we stayed in a apartment that he owned, and he was not living in at the time, and said we could stay there. So we stayed there for a few weeks, and I started receiving radio transmissions from my radio from Radio Tangier in Morocco and started recording things and just wanting to take them into a shop in Morocco when I got there and say, hey, what's this? You know, where can I buy this? And then I started getting into the commercials and the news reports and the strange other bizarre bumper music and DJs ranting and calls to prayer, whatever I could record, and I was just recording everything, and then just sort of developed the radio collage concept from that and just started sequencing things that were interesting to me that sounded like a nice sequence to listen to as a finished product, and that's when it started.
Yeah, but, and you have some of those recordings on Sublime too. Are some of those really early tapes part of the Radio Morocco?
Yeah, actually, the whole thing is from that trip, and it was all from 1983, and I had that put together in an almost exact manner back in 83 when I had returned home and just sequenced it together and had it on a cassette, and I just flip it around to friends and trade it with people in the 80s cassette correspondence scene that all of our friends were into, and people always said, well, you should release this, whatever, you know, and eventually when we started the label it became a reality.
Yeah, I mean it's a really wonderful way. Again, it's like it kind of points towards things that often we miss. You know, I mean, I know you like say you don't know what the heck you're doing, and in a way you are like going on gut a lot of the time, most of the time probably gut and adrenaline and drive. But
oh yeah, and as time goes on, you become more and more experienced at similar scenarios, and then you know it makes you feel a lot more comfortable. I mean, right now, I mean, I'm pretty fearless. I was always pretty fearless, but, you know, I mean, I have no problem going anywhere at any time, and, you know, it's all the same to me, and I'll find a way to make it work for me, and the language is never an issue, and, you know, it's all just for the experience and discovering, you know, everything, and the people and the music and the food and everything, so...
Yeah, I mean, and what's great about Sublime is that comes through in the way that you put things out, the way the covers are put together, the way things are sequenced, the way you find new people who are, you know, become part of your umbrella, and even just the kind of music that's put forward, because it's really like a very different, it's sort of like, you know, world music from a parallel universe. I mean, it's a terrible phrase, world music. What the heck does that mean? But you know, and you were definitely motivated. I remember talking to you before about what you were frustrated about with how, you know, music from other countries was sort of represented and packaged and framed, you know, certainly in the 80s when it kind of started to become more of a genre. And it seemed like at the time, like you'd either find pop recordings where they were, you know, trying to, you know, go towards some idea of like a global audience, and, you know, some, you know, horrific production decisions were made in the 1980s
right,
with African music and things like that. Or you'd get the real, you know, noble, earnest, but sort of sterile kind of ethnomusicological thing with all the details and the data, and everything is sort mm-hmm. of like, you know, and there's not a lot really in between.
That's it, and there is so much out there. It's endless, really. I mean, there's so much music to listen to and to discover that you're really, you know, going to be blown away by it. It's in every country you can find, you know, plenty to sort of occupy your mind for a long period of time, if not your whole life. I mean, a place like Indonesia or India. You know, these places they're sound museums, and it never ends, and there's so much happening and has been so much happening there that it doesn't matter what period you're mining or investigating, it's seemingly endless, and that isn't being represented, you know, in mass the same way that, you know, this Western friendly fusion of world music or indigenous cultural music mixed with the Western, you know, instrumentation just to make it sound more friendly to a Western ear, or the ethnomusicological angle of the more traditional instrumentation and documentation.
Yeah, you know, it was totally terrible. I mean, for me, when I would think of world music, it would be like some terrible hippie fest where people would be playing didgeridoos and stuff like that. I mean, it was really a total tragedy. And then you'd like, but to me, like as a teenager, all the coolest people that had like kind of a big influence on me would be listening to like crazy Indian sitar music, like not Beatles style, but more like, I feel like world music really turned into what the Beatles kind of presented as sitar music. But
yeah, and it goes way back. I mean, it was you know, being implemented in the early days of sound recordings, and with the ethnomusicological angle, you know, happening with documentation, you know, going
like
back
Paul
into the 1800s.
Yeah,
and then, you know, with the 60s and the, you know, the exotica, for lack of a better description of the, which is a term that I still have no problem using, that movement in the late 50s into the 60s, and then the Beatles introducing sitar and all. I mean, this stuff has been going on for a while, trying to get Western people interested in Eastern or Middle Eastern or foreign international music. And it's just because there's a million ways to present it, it's a shame that, you know, two or three basic ways of presenting it have been the model, and all the other, you know, different possibilities have just been sort of buried on private press releases and pushed to the side until recently.
Well, one of the things that really gets buried, and I remember very distinctly when it became an eye-opener for me, is the way in which, particularly in the 1960s and 70s, which is in some ways kind of a golden age because you had, you know, media globalization, the counterculture and the associated instrumentation, or not even just the counterculture, but just the kind of emergence of rock out of rock and roll and all that was, you know, it was a kind of global event. Teenagers in Indonesia or India or Vietnam or wherever were, you know, aware of this in various ways.
It was a worldwide renaissance in a way. You know?
And what gets suppressed in the kind of conventional way of thinking about world music, to use the lame test title, is how innovative the appropriation, you know, transformation, transmutation of a lot of those Western instruments and Western moves was in these other countries. And you just, unless you're like, you know, tuned into that stuff now, you almost just, it just blows your mind that it even existed. And for me, what really got me on that was there was a cable station in Brooklyn in the early 90s. There was this great, it was great cable system. It was tons of public access. All of these weird, low-rent feeds that were, you know, designed for all the variety of communities in Brooklyn. And so I used to watch the South Asian one, and I used to, and I watched, and they'd show these collections of the filmy songs from the movies, so you wouldn't have to sit there and plod through all you know, that an hour of mediocre acting to get to the completely bizarre music video that's buried in. They would just show these videos. And, you know, music's pretty good. Sometimes it's pretty awesome. And then I kind of got into this one composer, R.D. Burman, and I started going back, and I was going, man, when George Harrison was just kind of diddling around with his sitar in the back of, you know, Norwegian wood, these guys were, like, already, like, Frank Zappa, John Zorn, mixing and matching and, like, quoting different genres and bringing them back in, and especially R.D. Burman, and it really blew my mind. And then finally, this is the kicker, when I realized how it was being kind of suppressed, is I went into an Indian restaurant, like really early, like at 5 or something, and it just opened, and I was the only guy there, and I walked in, and they were playing, you know, pop music. They were playing, you know, filmy soundtracks. And then as soon as I sat down, they took it off, and they put on the Indian classical music.
And I was like, exactly. Yeah.
You're like,
that's
man.
What they do. Because you walked in and, oh, well, the tourist is going to, or the visitor, so to speak, has to be placated by what they're used to and what they would imagine as the cliche soundtrack for an Indian restaurant.
Yeah. So actually,
well, this brings up a great point, actually, which is, you know, when it comes to, you know, how the West, we all like to analyze and to to you know, turn everything into an encyclopedia of knowledge and absolutes in terms of what is the best and the greatest, the most productive, the stylistic, and everything gets broken down and overanalyzed where it really sometimes doesn't really mean anything. But you can't start talking about, you know, music in a certain time period, and let's use the example of the 60s and 70s, as you brought up, which is a period that I specialize in more than any other, especially the 60s. And basically, how can you make judgments on let's just take pop music or rock and roll for an example, about, you know, worldwide, this group had the greatest, you know, production of this type of sound and all of this, when, you know, no one's even considering, you know, beyond the West. They're not taking into account what was happening in Indonesia, what was happening in Thailand or Burma or India or North Africa, West Africa, wherever, South America. And if you're not adding in the majority of the world to the discussion, then how are you breaking it down? And it's just a one-sided argument, and it's just because of ignorance, you know, they just don't know, and this stuff needs to be sort of entered into the discussion, and it'll change everyone's perception of the historical significance and context of these topics.
Absolutely.
Entirely.
So in that spirit, I want to play a track. I'm probably going to mispronounce it. It's the Brothers Coes Bersaudara.
It's Coes Bersaudara.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, you're gonna play a song from I think it's 1967. It's the song that was sort of the first protest song in Indonesian history that attacked the government.
To the so-called guilties. Okay, so put up track one, sir.
You don't know what happened behind.
I love that guitar solo.
Oh, it's great. It's that's an amazing track. And it's actually in English, but the way that they pronounce the words, it's kind of hard to understand. When we released it, we printed the English, the translation of it as best we could. Even the songwriters, the main songwriter died in the 80s, Tony Cosuello, but the rest of the band didn't really know what he was saying, and we're trying to get the actual lyrics from them, and they said, well, why don't you guys just listen to it and just figure it out, and so I think we have it. So.
That's such a perfect, like, symbol of the whole process of what you're doing. I mean,
oh my God, it's endless. So, like,
I talked to you a lot about, you know, all this, especially the Indonesian music that you're really passionate about, and you have this marvelous collection of LPs that you've gotten over the years, and you're like, okay, now we can start putting this stuff out on these compilations, and you're like, okay, but, you know, how do we find out even the information on the records? Who's still alive? Can we get some dollars into their hands? Can we get, you know, and then it becomes this like whole other research level just to sort of try to translate this material into a more like Western analytic, like, you know, this song was written by this guy this time, you know, that whole kind of database archive, your side of the archive. I mean, that's half of what you're doing, really. I mean, at least with that stuff, right?
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, it varies. I mean, there's some times where we ignore that concept entirely, and we are more guerrilla in terms of how we go about releasing the item and leave it more to mystery than to try to define everything. And there's some other projects like the Indonesian project, which I think because I'm just so involved in the situation and I've had a chance to really, I mean, I can locate people. It's a lot easier to deal with. In one aspect, at least finding people, it's been doable. And I feel compelled to document it more because it's something that I can actually, I can find the information. It just takes a lot longer time to go through everything, to meet everyone, to interview people, to make agreements, do contracts, and there is no true legal way to release some of this music. There's no licensing company that you can go to in a lot of countries for music that's that old, you know, 40, 50 years ago, that you can just say, you know, okay, I want to use these songs. What do I pay you for royalties and what's the fee? And let's get this rolling and let's sign it up and do it. And, you know, you just can't do that. You have to try to locate the label or the artist, and we prefer to go to the artists because they really never got paid for the stuff anyway.
So
try
do you
to
have
get
like
money
a lot
their
of
hands.
Kind of Buena Vista Social Club type of experiences where you just track down all these old musicians and then try and give them money for songs that they did?
Well, I mean, that's, you know, the idea isn't to, you know, track them down to give them money because there's not a whole lot of money to give them. There's not a whole lot of money in this at all,
right?
Unfortunately. But, you know, they should benefit. I think the artist should benefit if the label is extinct and the label can't really be found because it doesn't hasn't existed in 30 or 40 years. I would rather just go to the artist and make the deal with them. It's their music. You know, whether or not, you know, the label had some sort of verbal agreement with them, very rarely was there ever a contract. They would just bring them in for a session, pay them something very minimal, if it anything at all, and then they would do the release and then, you know, sell all the records. They'd, you know, they'd go extinct after a while, and then, you know, the artist never really got much of anything out of it. It was all mainly about doing live shows. That's where the
yeah.
money was.
Hmm.
And it's still like that today.
So I'm curious, like, you must have some interesting stories of being able to track people down and them just, like, being completely blown away that anybody would be even remembering or caring, you know, after 40 years or whatever. Or
yeah,
maybe
that,
not.
That
maybe
happens
they're
all
like...
the time, actually, and they are blown away. And you know, even sometimes people who have a high profile, even today, you know, are somewhat blown away that someone from outside their country would be interested in them when... You know, they don't speak the language or they're not living in that country. And, you know, there is this element of surprise. And also the angle to where if you have a phone number for someone, they may call you back because you're a foreigner as opposed to maybe a local journalist because they get that all the time. But they don't really know what you want. They hear a foreign voice and they think, well, this is coming from, you know, outside, so I'm going to call this guy back. And, you know, that happens, you know, and then there, I'll know a journalist from that town that's been trying to reach this guy for 5 years, and he never calls him back.
Well, that's wonderful. Well, that's great. We're going to get to more tracks and more discussion, but we're going to take a break right now. You're listening to Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking to Alan Bishop on Expanding Mind, and we'll be right back.
Radio Network.
Oh,
same boat. Can't trust the corporate news because we don't know who's paid for it. And getting the truth about the issues that matter to us seems almost impossible. Well, get around the spin by tuning in to The Solution Zone with me, Christiane Brown, Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, where every week you'll hear from the nation's most respected journalists, activists, bloggers, and authors like Greg Palast.
Imagine Santa Claus came at your house and took 14 gifts from you and gave you back one. And asked you to say thank you. That's what Goldman is doing here. Why are we supposed to be happy that they're giving us a fraction of what we gave them?
Bill Maher.
Getting us to spend over $1 trillion on this mythical war on terror, to me, that is their plan, to get us to bleed ourselves.
Also to get us to give up some of our rights and some of our freedoms in the name of fighting that war.
Exactly.
And Glenn Greenwald.
Remember that the vast majority of what our government does takes place under full-scale secrecy. Most of what our government does of any real significance is kept entirely concealed.
Join us for The Solution Zone and get the answers you need. Thursdays at 3 o'clock Eastern, the Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, it's Paul Cavalcante with The Vinyl Experience. Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern and anytime in the archives. The Vinyl Experience. Great recordings spun from LP records. The culture of recording. Hi-fi and record collecting. Lots of cool music from the motherload of record albums that I've built up through the years as a DJ on New York City radio. The Vinyl Experience. It's a blast from the past, present, and future. CDs, cassettes, 8-tracks have all come and gone, but vinyl is here to stay. The Vinyl Experience, Fridays at 5 p.m. Eastern at PRN.FM. Give vinyl a spin. Load your iPod with past shows from the archives. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You are listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Eric Davis. We're talking to Alan Bishop about crazy music around the world. And Alan, I know Eric had said before, and I had read that you have been to Burma, or Myanmar, as it was known. And I know, like, when I went to Thailand, Burma was so mysterious and crazy and kind of gnarly. Like, you hear a lot about the government stuff that happens over there, and a lot of the Muslim stuff that happens around Indonesia and that area gets kind of sketchy. Like, did you have any crazy run-ins with any extremist politics while you were over there, or how was the situation?
Well, it's not as crazy as it sounds. I think there's a certain element of fear that's always spread to keep people from, you know, perhaps investigating into areas or traveling to areas where I assume the West would not, you know, want a lot of information coming out.
Well, don't they have actual rules where Westerners can't go to parts of Burma? Is that true or no?
Well, there's a way around everything, but, you know, you can you have to apply for permits in certain areas to go there, and usually, unless you're obviously a journalist or someone who is, you know, maybe marked as a troublemaker that's going to try to ruffle feathers or get people to, you know, align in a movement or something, you can pretty much get a permit to go anywhere as a tourist. You just have to wait for it and do the proper application and kind of plan ahead and know what you want to do. But, I mean, there's definitely an element of control there that is, we're talking Burma now, that is draconian, and, you know, it's their version of draconian versus our version of draconian, which is a different style. And, you know, the only times that I run into it are, you know, when you run into a situation to where there's a lot of soldiers or sometimes I'll walk into a hotel lobby and it's filled with soldiers, and it's a very interesting moment because you don't know what, you know, a lot of them are young, and it reminds me of the stories of the Khmer Rouge. You know, you have these, you know, 16-year-old kids with rifles, and some of them look even younger. And then there's older people there as well, and it's quite intimidating. But I think the most intimidating is when you're asleep in your hotel room, which has happened to me twice, once in Rangoon and once in Mandalay, and you get a visit at 3 a.m. when you're asleep from the military police. And they don't smile. You can't get them to smile. I always try to crack a joke or try to loosen it up, but it never works. It works with the Arabs, but it doesn't work with the Burmese. But it's the kind of thing to where you're coming out of a deep sleep and all of a sudden, you know, you have 3 or 4 guys searching your room and asking you questions. And it's just when you're most vulnerable in your own room, after you woke up, you don't even have a chance to really be coherent, and you're sort of being interrogated, and they're just checking to see what you're doing, and you know, maybe it's before a parade or something the next day. There's going to be some sort of celebration. They don't want any trouble. They're doing this to several different hotel rooms and other tourists staying everywhere. Everyone's registered. That the hotels have to report who's staying where, and that's why they take a, you know, copy of your passport and register you in. They report that daily. So everyone's going to know where you are, and it's routine. And if you understand it that way, then it's not a big deal. And if you don't have anything to hide and you're not there, you know, to challenge them, then it's not an issue. So it never really goes anywhere other than just, you know, as an experience.
Well, I remember one thing you said about Burma that really stuck in my head, because it really challenged, like, whatever, just the kind of generic ways that I would be thinking about the world, is that, like, you know, you go there and you see the signs of this, you know, draconian kind of repression, and obviously you see tremendous poverty and lack of the sort of signs of globalization that we're now used to seeing, you know, everywhere, all throughout the third world, and you know, even in villages in Laos or whatever, you see this kind of, you know, I mean, globalization is everywhere, but it's almost like this weird, like I think, you know, Cuba looks like in some ways, where I've never been to Cuba, but where there's this sort of, it's a little bit like land of time forgot. And even though, you know, you don't want to say like, oh well, these people are, you know, in some ways better off for not being part of globalism, you did point out to me, it's like, yeah, you lose things when you go into that this sort of, you know, brave new world, and it really kind of brought a different, you know, frame to my eye just about how, you know, precious, you know, certain places and sources are outside of the framework of this machine that just wants to kind of consume and bring everything into this hot white digital, you know, moment. And I'm really curious what's going to happen now? What do you think's happening?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's never been a more confusing time for all of us to try to figure out what's happening. I really don't know what's going to happen, but you know, when you talk about globalism and the effect it has on everything, it's, you know, there's always going to be corruption, there's going to be killing, there's going to be an intelligentsia and a power elite that's going to be vying for, you know, control of any area, whether it's the ruling junta in Burma that's doing it their way, or you know, if that opened up into a more commerce western globalist designed new Burma, you would have a new set of rulers in there doing it in just a more beautiful and a more politically correct way. And so I don't know which one is better or worse, but you are going to lose, you know, the charm and the original, the more original sort of lifestyle that has been there for, you know, for a long, long time. And I don't know if it's good or bad. It's hard to deny people, you know, what they may want, but, you know, they're getting sort of, in a sense, engineered to want what they don't have, and we all seem to want what we can't get. It's this inherent thing in us all, you know, whether, you know, it's a material item or a better life or that girl that you know when you know you're trying to, you know, you're in love with someone and they're not in love with you, you can't have them, you know, this whole thing. So it's an issue that is the problem I have with it the most is that it's bringing up topics and talking about it in a way to, sometimes I'll defend the Burmese junta and say, look, you know, there is no point of view outside of Burma, outside of the juntas, that is defending them. So I'm going to take that point and I'm going to defend them. And then take it from that point of view because it's uncool to do so. And the same with North Korea. I'm still waiting for someone to show me proof that anyone's ever starved in North Korea. I haven't seen it. I mean, it's said all the time. You just go do searches and you can see some grainy videos of a guy laying on the ground and they're saying that he's starving to death. But I haven't seen any proof, real proof, of anyone starving in North Korea. It's just people that say that they've been starving there.
Well, I really remember. I love that you did that Axis of Evil little sort of mini collection on Sublime Frequencies with, bringing sounds from some of these places, you know, and just kind of presenting them like these are radio.
Well, it humanizes the place instead of demonizes it, you know, and that's the issue. It's no different than food, you know. And I often use this analogy. It's, you know, a lot of people ask us if what we're doing with Sublime Frequencies by releasing music from North Korea or from Myanmar, Burma, from the Middle East, Iraq, whatever, is it a political statement? And then I'll just turn around and say, well, if you went out to an Iraqi restaurant or a Syrian restaurant, is that a political statement? You know,
yeah.
I mean, is it
exactly?
Maybe,
well, you know, I want to play one of the tracks.
Know, food is music. Music is food. It's just and when you know you have somebody like Omar Suleiman performing to the West wearing a keffiyeh and sunglasses in a traditional Islamic the jalabiyah on stage and for lack of a better description, a massive amount of white people from the West praising him and loving what he does, you start to wonder, well, when have you really ever seen this? You know, where a bunch of normal, you know, Western people are praising a cliché-looking Arab person.
Right.
You know, it doesn't really happen much. And it's a good thing. It's a positive thing. Is it political? I don't know.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah. Even just that example of just thinking this last year of, you know, we talk about the Arab Spring a lot on the show, is just how that changed, challenged, and transformed, you know, Euro-American view of Arabs and of Arab culture and what the potentials are in that thing. So even if, like, being able to enjoy Omar Suleiman, which is an amazing story in itself, you get this guy from Syria, you put out a record, the Sublime gets enough attention, people like it, they really like his music, you make a tour, and he actually kind of blows up a little bit. He's like, people love it, and, you know, he gets to remix records and be part of, like, have this kind of funny, you know, move through the Western musical culture. But in a weird way, it's kind of parallels the fact that like, all these, like, scruffy, you know, activists in the Occupy movement are, you know, directly inspired. And to be able, just to have these people be able to say, yeah, we are inspired by Arab youth, it's mind-blowing, I mean, if you think about it from just 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Well, and there's a million ways to be active, and there's a lot of ways to do it. And I think when I was younger, I was more into, you know, the cliche styles of activism and going to demonstrations and writing about it and showing up at meetings and you know, being visible out on the street to challenge things with signs. And, you know, I think I was one of five people demonstrating against Reagan bombing Gaddafi and killing his kid in 85 or whenever it was. And we were almost getting stoned to death walking through a handicrafts fair in Tempe, Arizona, because we held these signs up that said, you know, murdering, murderous USA kills children or something in Libya, you know, getting almost stoned to death and chased off by jocks and people who were, you know, socially engineered to buy into the rhetoric that was happening at the time. But, you know, it's another way to present music and to another way of being active is to show a human side to that which is continually demonized. And
yeah.
And the Arab in the West has been demonized my entire lifetime. And it's nice to be able to actually consider the Arabs from another angle. You know, you listen to the music of Iraq or the music of Syria or the music from Egypt or North Africa, and it's something that moves people, and when people can put a face to it, and then the country and the music and the sound, and it opposes the terrorist paradigm or the belly dancer, oil sheik, camel jockey, and all the rest of it. So, it's battling on that front, and I think that's as effective or even more effective than trying to do it with a discourse and argue and debate
We're in a unique position to do that in America, because in America there are communities of those people. You can go eat at a Syrian restaurant, you can go eat Moroccan food, and there'll be a community of Moroccans there that are like making your food, or Ethiopians or whatever from around the world. If you go to some of those other countries, you're not necessarily going to be able to go and hang out with a bunch of white people and Westerners,
You'd be surprised, actually. There is always an expatriate community from most European, American, all these different countries usually have a presence there. It's for a different reason, perhaps, but usually there's a colonial or imperialistic reason,
right,
for a lot of them to be there, and some are going there to study, and some are more innocent reasons, like maybe what I'm doing or other people just wanting to learn about music and to experience the situation, and maybe it inspires them to write, to make a film or whatever. But it does have that more imperialistic, slant when you find, the West there.
Mm-hmm.
Here I think it's there's a brain drain as well, of taking some of the greatest minds from the less developed countries and inserting them into the West, and therefore they're not around their own people back home to make things better. Instead you've got these corrupt dictators or these these complete assholes that have no clue how to do anything, and they're just all in it for the power and control and status, ruining their countries, and you don't have a balance there.
Well, I was going to ask you, just talking about the image of the Arab and the kind of mixtures in the West and there, and you're part Lebanese, and it's really interesting because it's in a way it's a very important part of who you are, where your music comes from. And at another level, it's not something you kind of like carry around. You don't have like you or your brother, you don't have like tags, to the side, like, oh, we're half Lebanese, like we're mixed. We're not just like, you white guys over there. And it always struck me as like a real interesting, just a sense of how you position yourself in terms of all these flows.
Well, actually, I think now that after hearing that, I want to say it the way you said it. Hey, we're half Lebanese. I'm just going to start saying that everywhere I go. Look, man, I'm half Lebanese. Fuck you. Oh, get out of my fucking way. Our people are going to fuck with you right now. Well, we're bishops too, it's
yeah.
It's English, and my dad was a hillbilly from Tennessee, and my mom was born in Texas, and which she was Lebanese, so we're Lebanese hillbillies, I guess. But I don't know. I don't think it's that big of a deal. There is an issue though that you hear a lot when it comes to it's okay if you've got Arab blood to criticize Israel, but if you're not in the state where you could kind of justify it because you're Arab and you're just a purely European descendant and you're criticizing Israel, well then you shouldn't criticize them. I've heard that as justification of why you shouldn't criticize Israel from those who argue this point, and it's completely absurd. So
Like saying women can't criticize men because they're not men.
Yeah, I mean it's just unbelievable. It's just the whole idea. So it's fairly well documented that I like to criticize Israel. See any other way.
So we I had all these great tracked up here, and I'd love to play another one. We were talking about Burma before, and just because this just gives you a slice of, like, a kind of music, and a lot of the Sublime releases do this where you're like, I don't even know where to put this. Is this folk music? Is this, like, some kind of weird jazz that I don't know about? Is it, like, a mixture? I don't even know what this music is, which is part of the fun and the excitement of it. So we're going to play something from the Princess Nicotine Tuna, the first entertainment.
Yeah,
so wild,
no
man.
Charts,
so
all by memory.
Yeah, it's like, when I listen to that stuff, I'm like, I noticed that when I was in Burma and looking at, you know, listening to some of these sort of traditional bell ensembles, I'm not even sure what you call them. They look kind of like gamelan bells, but they have these circular drum kits. I mean,
yeah,
the
Sang Wang Orchestra. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And just listening to it is like the closest analogy are like the really complicated Frank Zappa songs, like where like all of these guys have to be like totally on, totally tight. They're like, they have all of the runs down. It's like very complicated. And it's like, you just don't, you know.
When I first landed in Burma and turned the radio on, I thought I'd landed on another planet listening to this stuff, sampling it on the radio. I was stunned. Why am I not hearing this? Why haven't I been able to hear this? Why is it? It's a one-way cultural export highway leaving the West, going into the East and South, in every direction outside of it, and there's no reciprocal highway coming back in so that we can hear what's going on there. And it's just the way it is, and that has to be reversed, and it is being reversed slowly.
You know, and that was also a big part of your own, I mean, it still is a big part of your own music. I mean, part of what was great about listening or seeing the Sun City Girls live is you know, you wouldn't know when you'd go somewhere else. You know, you might be here with some tune or genre that you could identify as being sort of, you know, American. And then the next track, you're like somewhere else, and you're singing, and we're not even sure whether you're singing in a real language. Maybe it's like a fake language, and it's some voice that sounds like some creature that is being channeled by some spirit medium in Burma or whatever. And it's like, so it's not just about listening to the other. It's also about creating a space where you can be inspired and actually sort of have it affect you directly, you know, not just...
That's exactly it.
You know, putting it in a box or something.
That's said
like
very
that.
Well. I mean, it's we incorporate what we experience into our own reality and reprocess it, you know, in our own way. And we had the freedom to, you know, everyone in the group, you know, we had the freedom to do whatever we wanted to do, and everyone was open to new ideas, and we didn't have to become bogged down with a particular style or reputation or logo or concept. And it was just changing as to our, you know, year to year, month to month realities, and just naturally moving. And,
yeah,
and that's what it's about.
Something else you told me that really stuck in my head. You were showing me the gamelan that you had bought, and you know, and we sat down, we started screwing around, and I said, like, you know, hey, how do you play this thing? And he goes, well, you just play it. And he started talking about how you understood why people like in the West would learn how to play traditional gamelan and train and all that. And he said, you know, yeah, I get that or whatever, but you said, like, but in a way, you're not really respecting the original culture if you just try to imitate it and try to just play it. And like, in a way, it's precisely by exploring that you respect the origin, which
it's
is
true.
Totally,
I mean,
the opposite of the way that most people think. But the more I think about it, the more true it is.
It's true, and even over the, you know, if you walked over there to Jakarta and walked up to a little troupe playing on their gamelan setup, and you were just going to try to imitate what they're doing, you know, I had a discussion with some gamelan players about it, and they would prefer to experiment anyway than to just play the same old shit that they're used to playing. And okay, so I can learn how to do what they're doing. I can mimic them. Well, that's just mimicking and copying something.
That's where reggae and dub come from, you know?
Yeah,
like,
I mean, you have to explore. You have to push the boundaries, and that's how they got to where they are with the gamelan as it is right now, by experimenting to get it to that point, and who knows where it's going to go later. As long as they leave the synthesizer out of the gamelan orchestra, I'll be fine with it.
Ah, the dreaded synthesizer.
Ruins everything.
Like
it's
that,
like
that.
A fine shit mist that covers the room, you know, when it gets turned on.
Also, just like 80s production, like when you're listening to like a lot of these recordings, and it's like, it's great. 60s, great. 70s, great. And then you start getting into the 80s, and then like they just got the wrong, bad machines, and you're like...
I know it's that's a topic unto itself. So that's another hour episode of your show, but I don't know if it applies. But
kind of amazing how like people will hear those sounds. Like even say, you know, someone in another country will hear a synthesizer sound, and then they'll use like some ghetto backyard technique to try and mimic that sound. It's kind of amazing that phenomenon.
I prefer that actually. You know, I mean, there's a lot of interesting ways that people are going to, you know, adapt to the technology that's available to them. And you know, when you hear, I'm much more forgiving of different tones and qualities of recording, you know, synth or keyboard sounds that are not trying to, you know, match, you know, the backdrop of a Phil Collins ballad, you know, and all this stuff that we've been inundated with, these sort of, you know, I don't know, the worst of it, really, you know, these several, and the same with guitar tones, you know, what was wrong with the 60s and 50s and 60s guitar tones? We seem to have sort of settled into whatever the 80s came up with, and, you know, as a standard that still to this day is very popular, and not really enhancing what was happening before. Why didn't what was happening in the 50s and 60s become the standard? You really can't go wrong with all those different tones and the different ways. It's more dangerous sounding. It's more vital, and you know, the more watered down nearer historic guitar and keyboard sounds are less threatening and more dumbed down for the populace.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know what I want to do is I'd like to go out here with an Alvarius V track, your solo creature, your solo entity. But before we do that, I just wanted to thank you again for being on Expanding Mind.
You're very welcome. Anytime.
And, good luck with your future releases. So this track was also a Sun City Girls song, I think, Alan. 3D Girl.
Yes, this is a different version that I used on the last Alvarius B record.
And one part of what's cool about playing it now is that you'll hear, even though it doesn't sound like it's from somewhere else, you can hear the exoticism in it. You can hear that inspiration, that real haunting sense of otherness that we all have it in some kind of weird way, brings us together. So thanks a lot.
All right, thanks, Eric. Thanks, Maja.
Thanks.
Keep your minds open.